Kickstart your day at 7 and get the news you need from the perspective you want. News One Now with Roland Martin, every weekday morning at 7 on TV One.
Good morning, folks. I'm Roland Martin. Next on News One Now, the new Congress, the 115th Congress, they will gavel into session today. And guess what? The Affordable Care Act will be at the top of their agenda. Well, actually, the House ethics was at the top of their agenda. Boy, the Republicans screwed that one up. We'll break that down for you as well as President Barack Obama also goes to Capitol Hill to rally Democrats somehow to stop Republicans from appealing the Affordable Care Act. We'll break it down with our panel. Folks, there is public backlash along with a tweet from Donald Trump forcing the House Republicans, as I said, to blink on day one of the new Congress. We'll talk about them and their issues with ethics. Also, folks, on today's show, we'll hear from NAACP President and CEO Cornell Brooks about why he and others were arrested yesterday in the Alabama office of Senator Jeff Sessions, who's been nominated by Trump to be the next attorney general. We'll break that down for you as well. Also, the largest congressional black caucus in history was sworn in yesterday. We will hear from the new chair, Cedric Richmond of New Orleans, right here on News One Now on TV One. All right, folks, plus we'll talk about the NFL. Will we see new black head coaches in the NFL? Don't hold your breath. We're back. 2017. Always bringing the funk. Let's go. News One Now, TV One.
The order in the Senate, please. Administer the oath of office.
All right, folks, the House and the Senate gaveled in yesterday. The 115th Congress officially came into session. Boy, Republicans, they really screwed this thing up on first day. They were supposed to focus on the Affordable Care Act repealing President Obama's signature health care law, but they chose to actually focus on ethics. Boy, that was quite interesting. And so I'll get to that in a second. But first, let's deal with Obamacare. It's been a rallying cry for Republicans for the last 6 years to repeal the Affordable Care Act. And of course, President-elect Donald Trump, VP-elect Mike Pence, they have made it clear they almost have also promised to kill the bill, to kill the law as well.
We're going to get rid of Obamacare.
We'll focus on repealing and replacing Obamacare.
The Obamacare repeal resolution will be the first item up.
Well, President Obama is putting up a fight on the way out of office 2 days after returning from his last Hawaiian vacation as president. He will meet with Democrats today to fight to keep the law on the books.
This has become sort of a holy grail for Republicans, based on ideology and not facts. The fact is that we have the lowest uninsured rate in history. The fact is, despite all the predictions to the contrary, healthcare costs have gone up more slowly since I signed that law than any time in the last 50 years. The fact is that the law itself provides protections that are really popular. It's just people don't know it's Obamacare.
Well, that's part of the problem that Democrats have had in terms of actually selling this particular plan. Let's talk about this with our panel. Dr. Greg Carr, chair of the Department of Afro-American Studies at Howard University. Also, Lauren Victoria Burke, a political analyst and writer for NBC Black. Dr. Chris Metzler, a legal scholar, political scientist, and CEO of JMI Group. Angela Saylor, deputy to the chairman for the Gloucester Institute. All right, folks, let you hear. I'm going to start with Angela and Chris. First and foremost, okay, Republicans have been promising to appeal the Affordable Care Act. But in 6 years, they don't have a replacement plan. Is it crazy to repeal this and not have a plan to say, we'll figure it out over the next couple of years, send us your ideas?
Absolutely not. I mean, we don't want to repeat what happened before. A plan has to be put in place in order for us to move forward so that this bill will be whole for the American people.
But they have no plan, and that's the problem. I mean, so they are literally talking about, we'll take your ideas and we'll figure something out. I mean, the last thing you want to do is, I don't understand. This is sort of like, let me fire somebody, and I'll figure out later who we're going to hire. No, you probably have a good idea who you're going to hire before you get rid of somebody. You might want to have a plan, Chris.
Yeah, I mean, I think you have to have both repeal and replace, because the fact is, if you repeal it, you have nothing to replace it with. As they say, there will be pitchforks in the street, so to speak, because you cannot say, I'm done. We'll get to you later. You know, we're good. We just want to give you this promise, and at some point, we'll figure it out.
Go ahead.
Yeah, so I do think that there are some things that you will see eventually whenever the plan comes up. One, you can't get rid of the pre-existing conditions. Two, you have to allow children to be kept on their parents' health care. You definitely have to be able to do that. So I think at least those two things will have to continue.
Okay, so I'm trying to figure something out here, Lauren and Dave. So we can't get rid of pre-existing. We can't get rid of kids on the health care. If we got to keep subsidies in this deal as well, make it affordable.
So that's Obamacare, right?
I'm just trying to understand, what are you getting rid of?
Right, the reason that they don't have a plan, a replacement plan, is they don't want to replace it with anything. They don't want to cover people. They don't care about covering people's health care. And so their plan is to dismantle it, really, without anyone knowing. If they can message that, if Trump can message that without anyone figuring it out, which I highly doubt, when you have 29 million people on the plan, I don't think that they can get away with that. But unfortunately, Democratic messaging in the past has been so bad that they might be able to get away with it. Now, I don't think that they will be, because Nancy Pelosi is putting on a very specific, concerted effort to step up the messaging in a local way and not a national way, just coming out of Washington, which is really what they need. But can they pull it off? Can the Democrats pull it off? We'll see.
Well, Roland, I mean, that's why this space is so important. We have to shift the dialogue. The Republicans have a plan.
Yeah, they have a plan.
It's called Obamacare. He took it from them. They're saying they don't have a plan. No, you have a plan. What they can't do is admit that the reason they oppose this has everything to do with who proposed it, was Obama. They used this as something to parlay them with their way into political power. And now that they're there, like the Joker and Batman, they've caught the car. They don't know what to do with it. Why? Because they, in the sense they'd be opposing their own plan.
Right, which is why they branded his name to it.
Exactly.
Now, their bigger problem is that at some point, when you take something, obviously, when you take something away from people, they're going to probably notice that.
And also, when we say people, let's also be clear. Uh-huh. We're talking about a whole bunch of broke white folks.
Right. They're voters. Exactly.
Folks who voted for Obama in 2008, 2012.
That's right.
Who flipped the Trump in 2016.
Right. Right.
I read an article this morning that was just stunning to me. Where this one woman and her son on Medicaid, son was covered. They complained about it. They didn't like Hillary Clinton for other reasons, but they say, yeah, we really need to keep the Affordable Care Act. I'm like, what the hell? I mean, Angela, that's going to be a problem for Republicans.
That's right.
It will be a problem, but we also have to look at small business owners who have really been hurt by Obamacare and their ability to be able to keep people on their payrolls and be able to give them health care. I mean, we got some other facets going on here.
That's a canard. They have federal subsidies, don't they?
They do, but still, small businesses are being harmed. You hear doctors talking about how this Affordable Health Care Act is hurting them.
Well they're not going.
You have a good point there, but the thing is, at some point, the Republican Party has to decide to govern and have ideas. So if you want to fix the bill, then fix the bill. The president had proposed some fixes, so did the Democrats in the House. The Republicans rejected because they want to reject everything the president does. Now, without the president in the equation, they should move the fix that small business problem that you're talking about, which is a problem. And there are some things that need to be improved about Obamacare. There's no doubt about that. But can the Republicans govern is what we're about to find out.
That's look, right. here's the deal. First of all, the president is going to Capitol Hill today to meet with Democrats. I don't
know what they're doing.
Know what they're going to
talk
about.
Right.
But here's my piece. There's 16 days left in this presidency. He's going to have a big farewell event in Chicago on January 10th. My deal is, go out fighting, Greg.
Come on.
My deal is, this is what I would do.
He's not built like
this
that.
This is what I would
you
do.
That, bro.
I would say, Mr. President, go pick two cities.
Yes, sir.
In Wisconsin or Michigan or Pennsylvania that you won and now Trump won. Mm-hmm. Go there and make sure it's white as all get out.
That's right.
and say, you need to make sure that the law that actually gave you health care stays on the books. You need to be fighting for this. Challenge them on that. I mean, okay, fine, have a big farewell rally in Chicago, but go out fighting. That's what you should do.
He's not built like that. First of all, pardon Marcus Garvey. That's easy. He won't even do the low-hanging fruit. That's why he cannot be allowed to dictate the terms for what happens next. Chuck Schumer looks like he's going to ball up his fist. Keith Ellison probably needs to be the chair of the DNC, and Bernie Sanders is backing him. Obama needs to go ahead and go into that good night, brother, because you had 8 years to fight these folks, and you wouldn't ball up your fist before. I doubt we'll see that, and that's why you're not the president, brother.
You wouldn't meet with Congress before. Now, all of a sudden, you want to meet with Congress. And he needed these people to forward his agenda and never talk to them. But see, that outside-in strategy, I think, doesn't work. Yes, he could go and get some headlines and get some press traveling around, but the bottom line is what works in political advocacy is the outside-in strategy. We just saw with the ethics thing where everybody got scared
But Chris, Angela, that's my point. If he goes, because first of all, folks need to understand, I've said this to him personally several times over the last 7 years.
Sure.
Man, take the message not to a big city. Go to those places where they got bad health care.
Yeah.
Where they desperately need Medicaid, where they desperately need the Affordable Care Act, where it's 90%+ white, and look them in the eye and say, I passed this law for y'all.
Right.
And you need to tell your senator and your House members, don't touch this law. You got 16 days left. Go out swinging.
But he's not going to do that.
No,
I mean, he hasn't done it all this time.
That's right.
Well, no, I mean, he's had events, but what I'm saying is, look, you know they're going to vote on it.
Right.
My deal is make life as hard as possible on them by at least challenging folks and looking them dead in the eye and saying, y'all think I passed this law for some black folks and some Latinos? No, it's a whole bunch of broke, sick white folks in America who desperately need the Medicaid and the Affordable Care Act. And in fact, the estimates are that some 16 million of those folks who have a health care, the Affordable Care Act, are white.
That's right.
But it goes back to what Greg said before. Look, the fact is this president just simply, that's not his thing. I agree with you. That's what he should go out and do.
Yo.
He had 8 years to do it.
Yo.
He hasn't done it.
You got 16 days. Have that rally. I'm telling you right now.
It's very interesting. The Republicans are their own worst enemies. Most of them don't have a governor, the House side. This RAINS Act that they proposed yesterday will hamstring them so badly that they're not going to be able to dismantle Obamacare.
He already said Obama out.
First of all, again, that's what I would do. I would say, I would have one last rally and look them in the air and say, no, you call them right now, make sure you keep this law. Yesterday, of course, Republicans backed off of their plan to change the ethics rule. How dumb was that? I mean, the first thing you do in a private meeting, you want to change the ethics laws, put it under the ethics committee, say you can't get anonymous tips, you can't tell law enforcement of any criminal wrongdoing. Angela, what the hell was your party thinking?
You know what? I don't know, but there's always a silver lining, even in something that looks strange. And the silver lining is, yesterday, we saw what most people are fearing right now in terms of a Republican-controlled government, of it checking and balancing itself. And it happened within hours. And so I think that there is hope. As we look at Republicans being in control, that you've got a president-elect who will come in and say, hey, pump the brakes.
But here's the deal, though, Chris. The tweet that Donald Trump sent out, he didn't criticize the changing of the law. He just said, now ain't the right time, and he called the existing law unfair. So I'm not giving him credit for changing it. They heard from constituents who blew their phone lines up, and they reversed that sucker mighty quick.
Pitchforks in the streets.
The protests, that, you know, that sort of moral Mondays. You know, look, until white folks, poor white folks, realize they have to stop voting against their best interests, nothing's going to change here. And if you figure if they blow the phones up over an obscure ethics office, what happens when Social Security is
Medicare
being
Medicare and Medicaid, no
right.
question.
Right, and so, yeah, exactly, Medicare and Medicaid. I think Chuck Schumer, frankly, is going to use the Senate rules to the fullest extent. I have no idea why the president is talking to House members, because the rules don't allow them really to do anything. So it comes down to whether or not the senators on the Democratic side are going to get real, put holds on judges, and take the rules to the edge. They're going to have to do that for 2 years, at least 2 years. And I think Schumer is actually the guy that can quarterback.
I do too. And you know, it's interesting. In contrast to the Senate, the House, most of these people have never governed at any level.
Right. And so they came here as an anti-government.
That's exactly right. Exactly right. And while all the press is going on this Essex piece, that Reins piece, man. If they pass this Reins Act, that means every change in an administrative agency that's related to a law must be voted on by Congress. They have no idea how that will bog down their agenda. They don't even know how to vote anyway.
Yeah.
They're not going to be able to change anything if they vote.
You will get absolutely nothing,
nothing done.
That's right. And that's the whole thing. Right. That's going to be a disaster. But if you want to have, you know, 4 years of getting nothing done, that's up to you. But, you know, you need to really
They've had a lot of practice the last 8 years.
Yeah.
Hold tight 1 second. Coming up, News One Now, folks. Latest, what's happening with Dylan Roof. He's been convicted. Now they move to the sentencing phase of his federal trial. That's next right here, News One Now. Plus, the NAACP stages a sit-in in Alabama protesting the nomination of Senator Jeff Sessions for Attorney General. We'll talk with the president of the NAACP, Cordell Brooks, 15 after the hour. News One Now on TV One.
So you want the truth. Well, we got it.
That's how I talk. God knows it. I'm just straight.
It's News One Now with Roland Martin.
This morning, the punishment phase of the trial for convicted Charleston church killer Dylan Roof begins. Earlier this week, the judge ruled for a second time that Roof is mentally fit for a trial, allowing the 22-year-old to represent himself in the punishment phase. Last month, it took the jurors just 2 hours to find Roof guilty for the 2015 massacre of 9 people at the historic Emmanuel AME Church in Charleston, South Carolina. The jurors in the federal trial must choose between giving Roof life in prison or the death penalty. The retrial for the former North Charleston police officer Michael Slager, who shot and killed Walter Scott, will begin on March 1st. Slager's original state murder trial ended in a mistrial last month, after the jury was unable to reach a unanimous decision on Slager's guilt or innocence. Slager is charged with murder for shooting Walter Scott, who was unarmed, in the back as he ran from Slager during a traffic stop in 2015. A bystander recorded the shooting, and the video went viral, sparking protest across the country. A former Versace employee is suing the luxury retailer for discriminating against black shoppers. The former employee says a Versace store in San Francisco used a special code to communicate when a black shopper entered the store. The employee, who is black, complained about the practice and says he was later fired for not, quote, living the luxury life. The employee is suing for unpaid wages. Versace has denied the allegations and filed a request to dismiss the lawsuit. Folks, the Ford Motor Company is kicking off the new year by putting the brakes on a $1.6 billion factory in Mexico and is now investing in a plant in Michigan. The automaker plans to invest $700 million to expand an existing plant in Michigan, which will manufacture new electric and self-driving vehicles and create 700 jobs. The company's CEO says declining demand for small cars influenced the decision to stop the factory plans in Mexico. But he also calls the move a vote of confidence for the incoming administration.
We're also encouraged by the pro-growth policies that President-elect Trump and the new Congress have indicated that they will pursue. All of these factors, coupled with segmentation shifts that we're seeing in the marketplace, and our effort, of course, to fully utilize the capacity at existing facilities, have prompted us, obviously, to invest in Flat Rock's expansion and to cancel building a new plant in Mexico.
I don't know if you really can understand really the impact of this investment. This is equivalent to a new assembly plant.
Donald Trump is threatening to tax companies that move production overseas. He recently targeted General Motors. He took to Twitter and accused GM of importing Chevy Cruze sedans from Mexico. GM responded, saying all of its Cruze sedans are now made in Ohio, but the automaker still makes hatchbacks in Mexico. All right, folks, coming up next on News One Now, protesters in Mobile, Alabama stage a sit-in at the office of Trump Attorney General pick Senator Jeff Sessions. We'll talk with President and CEO of the NAACP, Cordell Brooks, who was one of the folks arrested on yesterday. Also, the largest congressional black caucus in history was sworn in yesterday.
We'll hear from the leaders of the group and their plans about how they will battle the incoming administration. This is News One Now on TV One.
Okay, government might have shut down.
Let's end this shutdown right now. Let's put people back to work.
Listen, there's never been a president in our history that did not negotiate over the debt limit. Never. Not once.
But you can count on us. Welcome to News One Now with Roland Martin.
All right, folks, Donald Trump has nominated Alabama Senator Jeff Sessions to be the next attorney general, but the NAACP and others are protesting the nomination. A civil rights group joined the coalition Alabamans Against Sessions for Attorney General to demand that Sessions withdraw his name from consideration. They rallied outside the senator's Mobile, Alabama office on Tuesday before heading inside for a sit-in protest. The group says Senator Sessions can't be trusted to be the chief law enforcement officer for voting rights, arguing he has ignored voter suppression in his own state and prosecuted civil rights leaders on trumped-up charges of voter fraud. Mobile's NAACP president, Lizetta McConnell, says Sessions is not fit for the job.
I say to you today that Senator Jeff Sessions have shown us his bigotry and racism by the words that came out of his mouth.
McConnell joined National President Cornell Williams Brooks and other Alabama NAACP leaders in this photo they tweeted during the protest. Joining us via FaceTime from Mobile, Alabama is Cornell Brooks, President and CEO of the NAACP, and Bernard Simulton, the President of the Alabama NAACP State Conference. First and foremost, Cornell, I want to go to you. This particular protest, why did you have it in his office in Mobile, Alabama? When the Senate yesterday was in session here in D.C., why not do this in D.C.?
Well, because we wanted to make the point that there are resident citizens of Alabama who have been living under voter suppressive laws, voter ID laws for years on end. Laws that, rather than Senator Sessions speaking out against these laws, he has in fact supported these laws. So we wanted to stand with citizens in Alabama to make it clear that his people, the people in his community, in fact disagree with the policies that he has supported. We wanted to be in Alabama to underscore the point that in Selma, that is the birthplace of the Voting Rights Act, is also his birthplace. We wanted to underscore his Alabama roots and the fact that we have opposition in Alabama. And we anticipate these same citizens leaving Alabama, going to Washington during the hearings to stand against the nomination of Senator Jeff Sessions for Attorney General of the United States.
Bernard, several of you were arrested on yesterday. So the question is, what's next? Is this part of a planned action over a period of time? Are you encouraging other NAACP state conferences across the country to also be engaged in this sort of civil disobedience?
Absolutely. We're asking individuals to, first of all, contact the senators, contact, you know, the members of the Judiciary Committee that may be from their particular state, and just to ask them and tell them and, you know, almost demand that they not confirm Senator Sessions. And as President Brooks has already said, you know, we here in Alabama know Senator Sessions best. And because of his policies of the past and the way he has voted on recent legislation, we cannot afford to have an individual like this as the chief law enforcement officer in the United States.
Cornell, first of all, more than 1,400 law professors have signed a letter calling on Sessions to withdraw and not to be confirmed. Also, former Deputy Attorney General Deval Patrick, who's also the former governor of Massachusetts, has written a letter blasting his activities because it was Patrick who defended some of the folks who Sessions went after.
Yes, and let me note a couple of things. First of all, Deval Patrick hired me as a trial attorney at the Department of Justice in the Civil Rights Division. So I know him, I know his integrity, I worked under him, point one. Point two, the law professors who signed on to this letter opposing the nomination of Senator Sessions are speaking to his legal record, his record as a prosecutor, his failure to enforce civil rights laws fairly and vigorously, and his failure to support legislation which would strengthen the Voting Rights Act. And so the point being here is that Senator Sessions has a long, detailed record upon which we have based our opposition. And our opposition is not confined to the Beltway. It extends across the country. And to President Bernard Simelton's point, we are encouraging people across the country to stand up and voice their opposition. And so whether that be in a matter of sending a tweet, email, letter to your senator, staging a sit-in, engaging in civil disobedience in a disciplined way, we are encouraging that. The fact of the matter is citizens in Alabama put their bodies on the line. We were arrested, sent to the Metro Mobile jail, spent several hours there because we were attempting to stand in the tradition of civil disobedience by a couple prominent Alabamians, namely Martin Luther King and Rosa Parks, by standing against Senator Sessions. We did that. We're encouraging others to do the same. And we're standing with prosecutors, with lawyers, with legal scholars, and people all across the country. And as someone who is a fourth-generation preacher, as well as a civil rights lawyer, and someone who started his career at the Justice Department, I am unapologetically and vigorously opposed to the nomination of Jeff Sessions, and stand with my state conference president in Alabama, Bernard Simelton, and his state conference, I should say, his branch presidents all across the state. So we are firm in our opposition, and we will continue and intensify.
All right. Gentlemen, we surely appreciate it. Thank you so very much for joining us.
Thank you.
I want to go back to our panel here, Dr. Greg Carr, Lauren Victoria Burke, Chris Metzler, Angela Saylor as well. Shelley, go to my iPad, please. This is the letter that Deval Patrick sent to the U.S. Senate. And this is what he said. He said he actually represented the gentleman who Jeff Sessions tried to prosecute. He said the theory of Mr. Sessions' case was that it is a federal crime for someone to help someone else to vote or to advise them how they should vote, even if and when they ask for such help. At the outset of the trial, the presiding judge, Judge Emmett Cox, a Reagan appointee to the district court, subsequently elevated to the 11th Circuit, rejected that theory as contrary to settled law and the Constitution. Mr. Sessions proceeded to trial on that theory anyway. The jury unanimously acquitted each of the defendants on all counts. Here you have here, Greg, where, look, as the chief law enforcement officer, and coming from Alabama, we still, first of all, we had this election for the first time, had a presidential election without the full enforceable rights under the Voting Rights Act.
That's right.
This is crucial. We see, of course, these voter ID laws. We saw how even in Wisconsin that law was approved and they were dragging their feet, even granting the IDs.
That's right.
We see the treacherous activity of Republicans in North Carolina mm-hmm. as they absolutely try to steal elections when it comes to how they have just raped voting rights there as well, other places. And so making the argument against Sessions on voting is crucial.
That's right. In fact, Brother Patrick is pointing out the prosecution Sessions had of the so-called Marion Three, a husband and wife who marched with Dr. King across the Edmund Pettus Bridge, another Confederate name there, just like Jefferson Beauregard Sessions. But Jeff Sessions' prosecutions have been political in that regard. Yes, he voted for the Voting Rights Act, but he then criticized the Voting Rights Act. I think Sherilyn Eiffel, who, of course, is executive director of the NAACP Legal Defense Fund, put it right in one of our recent op-ed when she said, you know, the Trump administration, they don't just spin, they engage in doublespeak. They're gonna promote him as a civil rights advocate, when in fact, he is the exact opposite. And all we have to do is look at his record. And, you know, finally, I think what Sessions is gonna do, if he is confirmed, is basically try to slow down the effective use of the Attorney General's office to promote our rights. And so the response to that, of course, is the kind of war that we see being fought now by the NAACP taking up the cudgel to fight this thing blow by blow in the courts.
Shelley, back to my iPad, please. And I'm going to go to you. This is what Deval Patrick wrote. While absentee ballots were used widely and to great effect by white voters and their advocates within his jurisdiction, Mr. Sessions investigated only the use by black voters and only where white incumbents were losing political ground.
That's right. That's right. Political prosecution.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, this has to be voiced and a concern. It is a concern. But what we also have to realize is that the environment that we're operating in, there's a 99.999% chance that Sessions is going to be confirmed. And so then the question becomes, what happens next? I can talk about Sessions from personal experience of working with organizations that I've worked with, like Inside America, and him championing our issues, working with Congressman J.C. Watts and championing our issues. And I say all that,
What issues?
Issues of for criminal justice reform, issues for helping to bridge the gap for African-American youth to have opportunities to intern in the Congress on the Republican side of the aisle. I can go on and on. You've got Bob Woodson, who has worked hand-in-hand with him on issues of poverty. But my point is this, Roland. My point is this. He's 99.999% going to get confirmed. And what I'm saying is there is an opportunity for engagement with him to work together.
But here's a piece, though.
On justice reform?
Go ahead, Lauren.
And somebody who's talked to Jeff Sessions a lot, he loves talking to the press. He talks very long about what he believes in. But you don't really have to talk to him to know that he's a champion of mandatory minimums. He's a champion of incarceration. He's a champion of long prison sentence. He's a champion of old school justice reform. I can't imagine that would change much. I mean, really, I think what the NAACP should be doing, all the other advocacy groups, is targeting about 5 senators, 5 moderate Republicans. That is the only chance they have here. You know, if they can get people like Portman and Susan Collins and Jeff Flake to at least listen or think about voting against Jeff Sessions, they've got a shot. If this assumes that all the Democrats, of course, vote against him. That's unlikely to happen in the U.S. Senate, that, you know, this is a guy who, you know, you guys may not want to hear this, but Sessions is kind of a nice guy. You know, a nice guy to talk to.
I mean, he's not a nice racist.
He's not right.
They're very nice person.
He's not a guy that is easy to hate. And I can't imagine his colleagues voting against
Chris,
him.
Chris, there was a piece here in the Washington Post, and this piece was by J. Gerald A. Baird, Joseph D. Rich, William Yeomans. They both worked in the Department of Justice. This is what they wrote. Shelley, the iPad, please. In his questionnaire he filed recently with the Senate Judiciary Committee, Sessions listed 4 civil rights cases among the 10 most significant that he litigated personally as a U.S. attorney for Alabama during the 1980s. 3 involved voting rights, while the 4th was a school desegregation case. Quote, "We worked in the Justice Department Civil Rights Division, which brought those lawsuits. We handled 3 of the 4 ourselves. We can state categorically that Sessions had no substantive involvement in any of them. He did what any U.S. attorney would have had to do. He signed his name on the complaint, and we added his name on any motions or briefs. That's it."
Yeah, I'm not sure exactly what to say about that, because as it relates to the role of the U.S. attorney, that is generally what the U.S. attorney does. So I don't know why it was necessary to kind of make this role seemed more than it was.
Because he's actually trying to burnish his credentials.
That's right.
Yeah, but, you know, his credentials are what his credentials are. And I think, as Angela said, he's going to be confirmed. The question then becomes, what is done after that? What does the Justice Department look like? Who else is going to be confirmed in Justice Department positions?
We know that. We know the Office of Civil Rights will be gutted. We know that Office of Public Integrity will probably get a little bit laxer. I mean, we know what a Jeff Sessions Justice Department looks like. There's no mystery about his record. But we got to fight one battle at a time. And if the advocacy groups want to go after him, they need to target 5 or 6 people right now.
And it's not
and
just
then
a
we,
black issue.
For final comment.
It's not just a black issue. I mean, remember, this is a guy who voted against the Lilly Ledbetter Act. That Goodyear plant was in his home state of Alabama. Right. White women need to be up in arms. The poor need to be up in arms. In other words, black folks, will, as usual, be the tip of the spear, but we've got to have a coalition. These people are voting against their interests when they put people like
this. Putting pressure on him before, doesn't matter if they're going to confirm him, it's let him know trust me, you were not voting rights, but we're going to be watching you every step of the way and demanding that you actually step up on these issues because it's still critical in 2017. Coming up next on News One Now, I talked with the new chair of the Congressional Black Caucus yesterday. The 49 members of the Black Caucus, the largest in history, were sworn in. We'll show you some of that, as well as hear from Cedric Richmond. Also, the NFL. Will we see more black head coaches in the NFL? There's a whole bunch of jobs available. Don't hold your breath. 21 before top of the hour, News One Now, TV One.
So you want the truth? Well, we got it.
That's how I talk. God knows it. I'm just straight.
It's News One Now with Roland Martin.
16 days left in the tenure of President Barack Obama. He will deliver his farewell address to the nation on Tuesday, January 10th, in his home city of Chicago. Yesterday, the president and the first lady arrived back from their winter vacation in Hawaii. In the announcement, President Obama says he is following the precedent set by George Washington, who penned a farewell address to the American people more than 220 years ago. Tickets for the speech are free and will be available on a first-come, first-served basis beginning January 7th. Of course, you can make it to Chicago. The White House will live stream the event on the website. They've also asked the broadcast networks for time to carry this as well. We'll see if they actually do that. All right, folks, so the Congressional Black Caucus kicked off the new year with a ceremonial swearing in. It's the largest membership in history, 49 members. This year's new members include the Senator from California, Kamala Harris, Congressman Anthony Brown of Maryland, Florida's Al Lawson. We were there for the ceremony and heard from several veteran members about the importance of the Congressional Black Caucus.
Congratulations, Godspeed, and continue to be the conscience of the Congress.
If we fail to learn the lessons of our history, we are bound to repeat them. We are here today in the hopes that all of us have learned the lessons of our history. We're here today to install new offices for the Congressional Black Caucus that sit before you today in historic numbers.
2016 is now in our rearview mirror. What a year. We find ourselves facing a very difficult political and legislative environment, unlike any that we have ever seen before. But I promise you, the CBC will rise to the occasion, and we will meet these new challenges. The consequences are too enormous for us to be indecisive and allow ultra-conservative forces and the forces of the alt-right to defend our nation. We will be strategic, and we will be unified in our work. There is no question that this brother, Cedric Lavon Richmond, Generation X, is well suited and well prepared to lead us in confronting these new challenges. Cedric, this is your time. I look forward to working with you. And most importantly, I look forward to following your leadership as you lead 49 members of this great caucus, the largest caucus in our history.
We were speaking of Cedric Richmond of New Orleans, the new chair. I caught up with Representative Richmond after the ceremony to talk about the focus of the CBC moving forward.
In terms of the Congressional Black Caucus, I think that there's strength in unity, strength in numbers. And we do have 49 different voices, but we have one common goal, and that is to fight for black people across the country, throughout the world, fight for poor people, fight for justice, fight for equality. And that unites us. And we're going to continue to do that no matter who's in the White House. Even if it's not the person that most of us would have picked, we still have a job to do. We've been through rougher periods in our past, and we're ready for this challenge also.
Already, obviously, Republicans want to target the Affordable Care Act. That's been crucial to many African Americans, but also other Americans as well.
Well, part of our job as Democrats and the Congressional Black Caucus is to educate people throughout the country that the Affordable Care Act is not just for African Americans, that there are many poor white people through rural areas and urban centers that benefit from the Affordable Care Act, especially when you start talking about pre-existing conditions, children under 26 being able to stay on their parents' health care. It's a phenomenal piece of legislation. It may need some tweaks, but you can't argue with the spirit of it and the effectiveness now that so many more millions of people are covered. So we're going to fight to protect it.
Took President Barack Obama a year to meet with the CBC. Do you hope, have you already sent a letter to President-elect Donald Trump saying he should sit down with Congressional Black Caucus to hear what your agenda is?
Well, we're going to finalize our agenda in the forthcoming days. And when the president is elected, we look forward to talking to him. And if he's serious about outreach to African-American communities, then we will engage and we will have conversations and we will help educate him on what the African-American community needs, because we've been in the trenches for a very long time. But I would just tell you that his first appointments or nominations have not been received as a gesture of goodwill or a effort to find common ground. So we just look forward to the challenge and anticipate it's going to be a challenge until we see otherwise.
Last question. What do you say to folks who go, okay, we don't even know what the CBC does. What is their relevance? What do you say to those folks who say that? I hear it all the time.
Well, you can point to a number of things. You can just point to just over the last 4 months that the people of Flint, Michigan are going to get aid for their water crisis because the Congressional Black Caucus stood up and demanding that it be inserted into a piece of legislation. So we're still working, and we will continue to work. And if you just ask students that are at HBCUs, it's our work that helped get student plus loan, parent plus loans corrected a little bit against a department that was going in another direction. So we still have work to do, and we're going to continue to do it. But as long as there are people out there that find themselves in circumstances that are beyond their capacity, through no fault of their own, we're going to help, no matter who they are, where they are. Whether it's flooding victims in Baton Rouge or South Carolina and other places for natural disasters, or whether it's children in Flint, Michigan, who had nothing to do with the water supply, which was done by bureaucrats to save money and not look at the greater purpose, we're going to be there to fight.
All right, then. Folks, real quick, Lauren?
I mean, I think they have we've yet to see, heard an articulated strategy, not only just from the caucus, but the House Democrats and really the Senate Democrats as well. We're hearing we're going to oppose, we're going to block, we're going to do this, but we're not hearing specific strategy. It's going to be interesting to see what we hear after the president leaves today about whether or not there really is a strategy to stop Donald Trump.
Greg, one of the things that I asked Representative Richmond that question for a reason. I hear it all the time. Oh, my God, they're useless, they do nothing. The average person has no clue the stuff that a member of Congress does. When people have right. issues in their district when it comes to their checks,
that's right.
when they need help, when it comes to grants,
yes.
it's a whole bunch of stuff that's arcane, whether it's taking stuff out. I remember, I mean, look, during the first couple of years of President Obama, the Black Caucus got, the reason that you had $4 billion that was in the financial reform bill was because of Representative Maxine Waters and Gregory Meeks and others. They fought the White House on it. And people were saying, y'all shouldn't oppose the president. That was $4 billion.
Yes, sir. Constituent services. And, you know, I laughed, Marlon, because when you said that, it looks like the average member of Congress right now doesn't know what a member of Congress does. the Republicans lost seats in the House of Representatives and the Senate. So, and if you look at the local level, look at New York, for example. You got Yvette Clark. You got folks fighting. You heard Cedric talk about this question of plus loans. But at the state level now, Cuomo signed some piece yesterday, say if your family makes less than $125,000, you get tuition free at state colleges. The CBC has to push that at the national level, and they do that.
Real quick, Angela and Chris, Will Hurd of Texas, not a member of the Congressional Black Caucus, so is Senator Tim Scott, not a member, but Mia Love of Utah is a member.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm excited about the historic numbers here for the Congressional Black Caucus.
The largest caucus in the entire Democratic Party.
And I'm also excited about Speaker Ryan having the first black African-American chief of staff, and Senator Scott and Senator Lankford in very high positions in the Senate. So I'm looking forward to democracy playing itself out. And I think that as America is in a new place, we've got a lot of opportunities.
Well, Chris, I'm looking forward to some policies that black people care about, Speaker Ryan backs.
Yeah, and I absolutely, and I think we, if the Congressional Black Caucus decides that it wants to be a true opposition party, that's what it needs to do.
All right, we come back. We'll see more black head coaches in the NFL. There's a whole bunch of jobs available. Let's see if a brother get a shot. We'll talk with a couple of sports journalists, including Kerry Champion of ESPN. We come back, News 1 Now, TV 1.
Wherever you are, we are your centerpiece for black thoughts in America. It's News 1 Now with your host, Roland Martin.
Jacksonville, San Francisco, San Diego, a host of NFL teams are looking for new head coaches. The question is, will we see black coaches actually get a shot? The Rooney Rule has been in place in the NFL that was put in place by led by Johnny Cochran and others to force these teams to actually interview African-Americans for vacant top positions. Well, we'll see actually what happens next. I want to join me right now, a couple of sports journalists. I want to get their thoughts on this. Joining us is Kerry Champion of ESPN, Comcast sports analyst Christy Winter-Scott as well via FaceTime. Christy and Kerry, how you doing?
Hey,
doing great, Roland.
All right. Good morning. Kerry, I want to start with you first. We have these available openings in the NFL. Will we see black coaches get a shot at the top job, or the NFL keeps recycling coaches like Jeff Fisher who just keep losing?
Yeah. You know what? That's always been the mystery. How does Jeff Fisher stay gainfully employed and he doesn't produce any more than a handful of winning seasons? You know, Roland, I have to be honest with you. I think there's a couple good candidates out there right now that look as if they could get a job. Terrell Austin, he's the D.C. in Detroit. He's a defensive coordinator there, and a lot of teams are after him. I think what you normally see is one black coach normally, maybe two each year, but it's not about whether or not people are adhering to the Rooney Rule, because they are. They are interviewing these black coaches. The problem is that for whatever reasons, there is a system, and we know the reasons, that is in place that makes them feel comfortable recycling people who have this reputation, and that's in air quotes.
And Christian, that's one of the issues. And when you look at Mike McCoy losing record as the head coach, just got fired in San Diego. Okay, right. He's out there. Now they say Ken Wisenhut might be a choice. He failed too.
Right, but when you have 88% of the 17 African-American coaches being fired after less than two seasons of having losing streaks, that's an issue. I think the rope isn't long enough for the African-American coaches to implement their philosophies. And I just think it's frustrating to have a coach like Mike Tomlin with the Steelers be characterized as a cheerleader when he has done nothing but do a great job there in terms of winning with his organization. So it's just frustrating. I'm not sure what the actual answer is, but we do know what the facts are, and hopefully it changes and some other coaches are given a great opportunity to expand their careers.
Who else do you see on the radar? Anthony Lynn was the coach for one game in Buffalo, Kerry. You also have Vance Joseph, the brother down in Miami as well. So you have a number of brothers who are offensive coordinators, who are defensive coordinators, who are sitting there, but the good old boy network is still alive and well in the NFL.
It's called that second chance. So you gotta have people to co-sign for you, right? So if somebody like Terry Bradshaw to say that about Mike Tomlin, as Candace just referred to, he's not co-signing, but then he follows it up with, I don't really know him that well. You need to be in that club. You ought to play that political game. And a lot of these coaches don't feel comfortable, black coaches, coordinators, don't feel comfortable speaking up about this issue because they don't know who has their back. If you get with an organization like the Steelers, you're really set. They're very much true to their values. They keep their coaches. They let them try to implement their play style. But a lot of these coaches don't want to speak up because they are happy just to have these OC jobs, these DC jobs, and they know when they get them, they do the best they can, but more than likely, you're not going to be a Marvin Lewis and be somewhere for more than a decade and not really produce. Or you're not going to be, you know, Mike Tomlin. This doesn't happen that way, and it's because they're not familiar. It's this club that they can't get into. Yep. They just have to keep playing this game.
Well, and it's a club they weren't born into because they were born black. Kerry, we appreciate it. Thanks a lot. Christy, we appreciate it. Thanks a lot as well.
Thank you.
Go back to our panel here. I mean, that's the real deal. I mean, when you hear What you hear from these NFL owners and general managers is the same crap that black folks got to deal with in corporate America, got to deal with in this building behind us, the same thing. Yeah. Well, Chris Rock talked about it when it came to black folks getting jobs on Saturday Night Live, this whole deal of, well, you know, who we comfortable with and stuff along those lines. And that's, and so, excuse me, I was born black.
Roland, yeah. I went to Tennessee State, so every time I see Terry Bradshaw, I'm reminded of real affirmative action. I'm reminded of Joe Jefferson Street Gilliam, who should have had those Super Bowl rings. Terry Bradshaw is an example of affirmative action. Whiteness promotes itself. The brother at Buffalo, give him the shot. Rex Ryan gonna have another job. Chip Kelly, who ain't won nothing nowhere at the pro level, will have another shot.
Has already been head coach in two places.
Exactly.
The killer of it is when you see rookie coaches or coaches with terrible records like the Jeff Fisher thing. You know, Washington Redskins have Joe Barry, who's one of the worst defensive coaches in football, yet they can't find anyone.
Right.
Then their head coach is a rookie that they get. You know, Jay Gruden is a rookie coach.
And also, the Redskins had an awful offense this year, but their offensive coordinator is going to get a head coaching interview.
Right, exactly. All those guys get interviews. It's like, how does that happen? Yeah. And they have no black head coach in the history of the franchise.
But they take that expertise. Jim Caldwell can take, I mean, in other words, they'll let him sit in those positions.
Well, actually, in Detroit, the words out there, he's keeping his job, so he gets to stick around. real quick.
I just say, name Condoleezza Rice, commissioner of the NFL.
Right. Yeah.
There you go.
Because who's in control?
Yeah, okay. All right.
That's like Bud Selig in the Hall of Fame.
Right.
Put Barry Bonds.
Well, I think we also have some evidence that when you have one person black in charge, don't mean anybody about below them are going to do right.
That's right.
Back on News 1 Now in 60 seconds.
Wherever you are, we are your centerpiece for black thoughts in America. It's News 1 Now with your host, Roland Martin.
Birthday shout-out time. NBA player Al Jefferson turns 31. Actress Jill Marie Jones from the Girlfriend series turns 42. Fashion designer and Beyonce's mama, Tina Knowles, turns 63. Mezzo-soprano opera singer Grace Bunbury turns 80 years old. On this day in history, 1971, Dr. Melvin H. Evans becomes the first elected governor of the Virgin Islands. Folks, I'm going to see y'all tomorrow. News 1 Now, TV 1. Got to go. Holla!
Kickstart your day at 7 and get the news you need from the perspective you want. News 1 Now with Roland Martin, every weekday morning at 7 on TV 1.